Henrik from Sweden. The website is redicecreations.com. We are doing a shorter segment today with Sally Fallon. She is the founding president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, founder of a campaign for real milk and author of the best-selling cookbook, Nourishing Traditions, the cookbook that challenges politically correct nutrition and the diet dictocrats. She is also the author of The Nourishing Traditions of Baby and Child Care and Nourishing Broth. Well, this will be short but sweet and informative, so we'll get right to it. Hey, Sally, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's great to have you on the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. I've known about Weston Price for a long time now, and I'm really glad to finally get you on the program and actually talk about him, do a dedicated show, as it were, to his work and this specifically. But before we talk more about Weston Price, tell us just a little bit about yourself, when you got involved in this and, you know, the story. I know you've been involved many years now, so I guess it's a long story, but give us the short version if you can.
I'll try. So I read Dr. Price's work in the early 1970s, and it had a profound influence on me. In a way, it was a confirmation of what I was already doing, because I loved to cook, and we ate butter and, you know, ate real whole foods, lots of eggs and cream and all that kind of thing. And Dr. Price's work confirmed that, and I followed his principles, adding things like organ meats and so forth, for my growing children. And I just proved to myself that this diet works. My kids were great kids. They were never sick, and they didn't need braces, and they grew up to be very high-functioning adults. So once my youngest was in school full-time, I got the idea of writing a cookbook that put Dr. Price's findings into practical form. So the cookbook came out in 1996. The second edition came out in 1999. And then at that time, we got the idea of setting up the Weston A. Price Foundation to continue to provide accurate information as it unfolded in the scientific world.
All right, very good. And so why don't we just kind of dive into Weston A. Price, who he was, the kind of work he did for, give us an introduction for those who don't know.
Okay, so Dr. Price was actually a dentist, and he had a busy practice in Cleveland, Ohio, but he also was very interested in nutrition, and he spent 10 years traveling to remote parts of the globe to study isolated, what he called primitive people. He was very interested in reports that these people had beautiful straight teeth. So as a dentist, that's what he was looking at first. He was looking at the teeth, and he found 14 groups that had excellent dental health, no cavities and nice straight teeth, broad faces, bright, wide smiles. And he made the assumption, and it's a good one, that if they had excellent dental health, they had excellent overall health, and indeed they seemed to be healthy in every way. So then his question was, well, what are these people eating? What kind of diets support this good health in primitive populations? And the diets were all different. There were Eskimos in the frozen north. There were people in the South Seas. There were Swiss people. There were Gaelic people, and all of these diets were different. But there were some underlying characteristics of all of them, and the most important one was the very high levels of fat-soluble vitamins, vitamins A, D, and K, much higher than the Western diet. And the foods that they put the most emphasis on, that they valued the most, especially for having healthy children, were particularly high in these vitamins. So it's foods like organ meats, fish eggs, butter and cream from grass-fed animals, animal fats. These were the foods they valued the most. They were the highest in these fat-soluble vitamins, and, of course, they're the foods we're being told not to eat.
Yeah.
So we felt that there was a real need to get out and educate people on the value of these types of foods.
Yeah, so what has happened to our food system? And if we talk about the food in the West, I guess, and the typical diet, unfortunately, that most people stick to today, what kind of consequences is this having?
Well, the diet in the West today is appalling. It's appalling. It's way too high in sugar and white flour, and it's largely based on processed industrial vegetable oils, which are a disaster. They're just a disaster for human health. The modern diet avoids animal fats like butter, and even if you're eating butter and eggs, it's coming from animals in confinement. So when they're in confinement, they're not good sources of these vitamins. So we've gone just about as far as we can go to get away from good, wholesome, natural food and from natural farming methods. And the consequences, well, the consequences are chronic disease, heart disease, cancer, bone problems, immune problems, kidney problems. And it's most tragic in the children of this particular generation because they're suffering the consequences of their parents' bad diet. And we're seeing an epidemic of learning and behavior problems, of asthma, allergies, and eczema, and even diseases we associate with adults, such as arthritis and cancer.
Yeah, there's just so many issues that arise from this. And one thing that actually interested me in the last couple of years is the issue of infertility. There are actually a lot of things around this. We know that. But just the issue of fat alone is one that's very, seems incredibly dangerous. You know, in Sweden, we've had these raging debates for a long time now about how bad it is with, you know, real fat, like, you know, real cream and butter and these things. And they promote the vegetable oil based ones. And we've had one proponent talking about this for years, and she's been hounded by the media. She even was pushed to the brink of suicide, actually, a couple of years ago because they were so going after her on this issue. But what is so dangerous about leaving out proper, you know, fats? How do we explain this to someone who thinks that that's a bad issue and we should stick to the margarines and these kinds of things, right?
Well, there's been a 100-year campaign by the industrial seed oil industry to demonize their competition. That's exactly what it is. And they made us feel guilty to eat butter, and they made us feel like it's vulgar to use lard. And yet these foods are absolutely essential for human health, and the traditional cultures understood this. They ate the fat of the animal first. They usually threw the lean muscle meat away. And this is what we have to overcome to get back on the right path to a healthy diet. I'm interested to hear that woman was so hounded.
Yeah,
what a shame, because the scientific community, when it latches on to a fixed idea, they can be just vicious.
Oh, absolutely. She was like named some group. She was named the how would you translate that? Like the misleader of the year, I guess you could translate that to things like that.
Deceiver of the year.
Exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, I understand that in Sweden, people are eating more animal fats. They're not listening to the government, and I even think the government recommended a higher fat diet recently. But I want to get back to this infertility thing, because this is exactly what Dr. Price predicted, what other researchers found, that if you were on this displacing diet, in particular one in which vegetable oils displace animal fats, after a generation or two, you start to see lots of infertility. And there was a very interesting study done recently where they found that women who were consuming low-fat dairy products had trouble getting pregnant.
Yeah.
And when they switched to the high-fat dairy products, they had much higher fertility. And the response of the government was, well, if you're having trouble getting pregnant, go on your full-fat milk and your cheese and butter until you get pregnant. And then as soon as you're pregnant, switch back to the low-fat diet.
Right.
And, you know, the body is telling you something. If you can't get pregnant, that means on a certain diet, that means that diet is not going to support growth, optimum growth.
Well, I mean, this has been particularly marketed to women, of course, with, you say, tons of low-fat products, and then you have other dangerous things added onto it, like aspartame, as they're trying to get away from sugar and things like that. So it's very...
Right.
It's very detrimental, and I think that is largely responsible for the infertility issues that we see in the West at the moment, where women have to travel overseas and they have to do IVF and other issues to get pregnant, you know?
You know, the treatment for infertility among the American Indians was the bare fat diet. They got nothing but bare fat for a month, and that always worked. So lots and lots of fat.
Yeah, very important.
And bare fat is particularly rich in the fat-soluble vitamins, particularly vitamin K. And, you know, it's so simple. It's so easy, so inexpensive, and yet people are spending tens of thousands of dollars for fertility treatments that usually don't work.
Yeah.
Usually don't work.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, if we look at, we can talk about how humans use teeth a little bit more in detail here in a while, but if we look at animals, for example, I was watching a documentary the other day about bears, and they, you know, when the salmon is rich, they actually just eat the skin and the brains alone, and they throw the rest away. You know?
Exactly. And same with the lion.
Right.
The lion goes in the belly of the animal and eats all the organ meats and leaves everything else. And that eagles do that too. They'll kill a chicken, for example, and eat the innards, but leave the meat and the feathers and all that.
So we have an approach to this now where we cut everything out and just go for the fillet of the animal, right? So
I know.
And it's a waste.
And traditional cultures never did that. In fact, they knew it was dangerous to eat lean meat.
Yeah, there you go. It's incredible. So I know he traveled around, visited a lot of different cultures from all over Europe to those that still were, I guess, in a state of not being industrialized yet, and then to other parts of the world as well, and looked at what they were eating and things like that. But you mentioned something about broad faces. What do you mean by that? Tell us about that.
Okay, so wherever he went when they were on their native diets, eating these very rich foods, rich in fat-soluble vitamins, they had excellent facial structure. They were very wide in the cheekbones, and the dental palates were large, so there was plenty of room for the teeth. So everybody had naturally straight teeth. As soon as they switched to the displacing foods of modern commerce, the processed foods, the first thing that happened was they suffered from tremendous tooth decay. But the next effect was in the next generation. The children born to parents who had changed their diet had more narrow faces. They didn't have that beautiful high cheekbone structure. And their dental palates were not as wide, and their teeth were crowded. So it happened in one generation, the change from the really attractive facial structure to the narrow and crowded facial structure. And the first bone that's affected by poor nutrition is the maxilla. It's the upper jawbone. It's the bone that determines the shape of the face and the width of the cheekbones.
Wow. That's interesting. So how do we explain that? How can it change so quickly?
Well, it's interesting. The maxilla, so if you can picture this bone above that forms the upper jaw and the cheekbones, at the edge of each cheekbone is the growth plate. And if if that bone is nourished properly, and vitamin K is very important here for keeping that growth plate open until it's reached its maximum size. And if the growth plate closes too soon because there's not good nutrition, then the cheekbones won't grow wide. They'll be narrow.
And that then consequently has a consequence on the entire facial structure and the
right.
skull as it grows from young to adult, right?
Absolutely. Every other bone in the skull touches on that maxilla. And, you know, it's the same with our long bones in our body. They have growth plates at the end. And if they close too soon, if they close prematurely, the individual will end up having a short stature. They won't get to be very tall. And we do know that good nutrition has a lot of bearing on how tall a person grows.
You know, that's very interesting because I've always thought about that, too. We heard if we go back a little bit centric here, but go back to Norse history and look at the Scandinavian people. We've always heard in the past, of course, that they were very they were taller than other people at the time. But then later in the, I would say from probably 1600s and definitely up even to the late 1800s almost, we had a very short stature on a lot of the people. And I was always curious why that was, because we know that the Norse people, of course, they had rich like cod liver oil and very, high fats and things like this, right? So that could be one of the reasons why they were known as being tall, but not, kind of mid-millennium all of a sudden there, right?
Yes, well, we've seen that whole pattern going from tall to much shorter and then tall again, because really up to the Second World War and even beyond in Europe, we had a good diet. It was a plenty of dairy, good dairy foods, and that's also important for height. But I think what we're going to find in further studies is that the growth plates on the maxilla close before the growth plates on the long bones, because we're seeing today some really tall people with narrow faces.
Ah, I see. Interesting. So We could, in your view then, we could basically, can we repair the damage by giving a child the correct food immediately?
Yes, you can't repair the damage in yourself. I mean, once you've reached adulthood, you can't change your body structure. You could be healthier by following a healthy diet, but you can't change your body structure. But what we've seen this over and over again, that the parents who follow our diet, starting with preparation for pregnancy and follow our diet, their children tend to have wider facial structure. They don't need braces. I mean, we get report after report about this, and just that they're overall very healthy.
So we're also told that dental problems, especially cavities, is something that the body cannot deal with, right? We need to go to the dentist. We need to have them filled, etc. We've done some programs on this in the past, but it's a very interesting area. And of course, Western Prize came from the dental background. So how can we treat dental issues with the right food?
Well, it's interesting. Dr. Price observed many times that he found perfect teeth, no cavities in people who never brush their teeth. So he didn't think oral hygiene had anything to do with dental decay. And we've just learned in the last decade what the key factor is in preventing tooth decay, and that's vitamin K. Vitamin K helps the body put calcium and phosphorus in the teeth. And the teeth are living tissue. The calcium and phosphorus constantly needs replacing, and that's what vitamin K does. And the people who have a lot of vitamin K in their saliva are the ones who don't get cavities. So where do we get vitamin K? Well, we get it from all the foods we're not supposed to be eating. And one of the best sources in the Western diet is cheese. But things like goose liver and animal fats and egg yolks and butter and so forth, these are all sources of vitamin K.
Very good. I want to ask you if you're a believer in supplements and things like this, later doses and stuff like that, but what's your thought on fluoride and these kinds of issues?
Well, Dr. Price was adamant. He said, these people had perfect teeth and they did not have fluoridated water, and so he didn't think it was necessary. And he was opposed to it. He thought it was a toxin. And that's really what led to his demise at the end of his career. He fought against fluoride, and he was in what was called the National Dental Association. And they actually started a new dental association, the American Dental Association, and left him out completely because he was so vociferous against the fluoride. But fluoride is toxic. It's toxic to the thyroid gland. It's toxic to our enzyme systems. And especially the type of fluoride that they're putting in the water today, it's even worse than what they used to put in.
Yeah, it's absolutely horrible. I know that America does it in the majority of their water supplies.
I don't think Ireland is doing it.
Yeah, Europe doesn't. No, exactly. It's just Ireland, I believe, that actually has started doing it now. But we'll see if the EU or something want to push this on Europeans. But let's talk about some of the other effects here. We have, of course, a lot of older, women especially, I believe, but men also get osteoporosis and these things, weakening of the bone and things like that. Is that also issues that you think could be resolved with the proper nutrition?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there was a very interesting archaeological study in England, and they had exhumed bones from women, and this is about the 1200s, and they were absolutely amazed that some of these individuals were very elderly, and they found no degradation of the bones. The bones were in perfect shape, and that's because they had a really good diet. And there's two critical factors for the healthy bones. One is getting enough of these fat-soluble vitamins, and the other is getting the minerals you need, such as calcium and phosphorus. And, of course, dairy is traditionally the source of these in the West. But, of course, this was raw dairy. We know that the calcium and other minerals are much more effectively absorbed and utilized and put where they belong in the bones when the milk is raw, when it's not pasteurized. Once you pasteurize, the body doesn't use this calcium very effectively. The bones don't become as dense, and the calcium ends up in the soft tissue, like the arteries.
Yeah, I don't know why they're so incredibly scared of non-pasteurized milk, and they try to claim that people have, I think they try to say that people even died from it and things like this, right?
Actually, our government has kept records since 1972. There has never, never been a death from fluid raw milk in the United States. And during that same period, there's been 77 deaths from pasteurized milk. So it's the pasteurized milk that kills, because once pathogens get into pasteurized milk, they proliferate, whereas raw milk has components that kill those pathogens.
So what happens there to them? They boil it, right? Pasteurization is you heat it up, and then they homogenize it. They whip, I think, the fat structure apart or something like that, correct?
Yes. Well, first they heat it very rapidly. It's not really boiled. It's rushed past superheated stainless steel plates, a very unnatural process. And then they do go through this homogenization process, which is a very violent process that breaks down the fat globule membranes. And, you know, none of this is good. None of this is good for the milk. But it's good for the industry because it gives them a very stable product.
Is that what it's about, like consistency, that they'd have to look and taste the same all the time, right?
And the one thing about homogenization, when everything became industrialized and mechanized, it was the cream that was the problem for them. It stuck to the pipes, it stuck in the top of the bottles. Also, people could tell how good the milk was by how much cream there was, and they were switching to low-fat Holstein types of cows, and so the fat in the milk was less and less. And they didn't want people to know how little fat there was in the milk, so that's another reason they went to homogenization.
And in my view, Sally, I mean, it's the whole production chain here, the line that is a big problem, from what the cows are eating to how they're treated and everything, right?
It's insanity. It's really insanity that we think this, the production of milk, you know, one of the most delicate and most nutritious food on the planet, can remain the same after all this industrial processing. And, you know, that's ridiculous.
So basically, this is a philosophy, for the lack of a better term, that has been reached through observing how people have lived for the longest time. The one that is the most natural and basically down-to-earth way that you possibly could get your food. Isn't that correct?
Well, in a sense, we do, of course, recommend pasture-based farming and feeding animals the diets that they are designed to digest, to raise them outside in as healthy an environment as possible. But at the same time, we're not turning our back on modern science. There's a lot of great things about modern science, like having a freezer, you know?
Sure.
That's a great thing to have. Having a food processor in your kitchen. A lot of these things take the drudgery out of food preparation. And it's not like we're turning our backs on those things.
Sure.
But,
I get that. No Luddites.
But the way the animals are raised is very important. And to think that you can put animals in cages, very crowded, you know, thousands in the same building, and have them be healthy, it's not even common sense.
So let's speak about that a little bit, and the reaction to that we've had consequently, which is, of course, is spanning from vegetarianism to veganism, and what your view on these things are.
Well, I do agree with them that this is a monstrous system and that we shouldn't support it, but we do need animal products. Very much so, to be optimally healthy, and particularly to pass good health on to the next generation. I mean, it's really unfair to your child to be a vegan or even a vegetarian while you're pregnant, because that child is not getting enough of what it needs to be healthy for the rest of its life. You know, if you want to be a vegetarian or vegan towards the end of your life when you're not having children anymore, that's, you know, you're not hurting anybody, but to follow this practice while you're young is just not a good idea.
Did Price find any people that ate vegetarian or vegan?
No, in fact, he had hoped to. This was called Dr. Price's greatest disappointment. He had hoped to find cultures that were healthy and that only ate plant foods, and he never found that. He said they all ate animal foods, and they all went to a lot of effort and risk to obtain the animal foods, and all of what we call the sacred foods, the foods that they felt were so important for having healthy children, they were all animal foods.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So a lot of these issues then are based that we have today on malnutrition, basically, and there's a number of reasons for this. We have topsoil depletion, the animals are getting, GMO corn as opposed to being grass-fed, and all of these issues, right, which is causing just a cascade of effects all the way down to us. But, I mean, the reasoning here you have to have is to look at how sick people are today as compared to, you know, many, many years ago. And I was, sure, there's been problems throughout history. I'm not trying to say that. And many people also lived a very tough lifestyle. But I've said this before, that I think that if we gave the food that we are eating today to people who lived even 200 years ago, they wouldn't, you know, survive a couple of months even, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yes, it's just, you know, to me it's amazing that people don't make this connection with diet. The doctors who are working with sick people all the time don't think it has anything to do with diet. They blame it on what I call the three G's, germs, genes, and God. But the diet, just, they don't think it has anything to do with the health of these people.
So what do you do to convince people of this, to get them to see and ultimately then try to get them towards a more healthy lifestyle?
Well, I never impose this on anybody. You know, unless somebody asks me, I don't even talk about food. It's a very sensitive subject. But we are there when people are ready for our message. So, you know, I speak all over the country. I'm speaking to people who want to hear me. I remember once somebody said, we'd love for you to give this talk to our women's club. And I said, well, I just don't think that's a good idea. Unless they all want to be there, they're not going to like what I have to say. So you just have to be there when people are ready to hear the message.
Why do you think that is? Why are they so...
Yeah, food is a very sensitive subject these days. It's more sensitive than sex or money or religion. And people are very, very resistant to hearing things that are different from the way they're doing things in their kitchen.
Yeah. So have we, do you think genetically kind of, we've risen to a place where we, you know, due to our surrounding and our environment, we've gotten, we've used the land, we've used what has been around us in a certain way, and I guess genetically or evolutionary, however you want to term that, we've developed in such a way that we're kind of hardwired to eat this kind of food. And now then, when we're turning away from that, turning our backs on that and doing this new modern diet, very processed, as you say, a lot of flour, a lot of sugar and things like that, that's one of the reasons then we have this so many health issues and effects, right?
Yeah. I mean, our bodies have a basic requirement for nutrients. We need certain vitamins and minerals, and we're just not getting them in our diet. We need certain types of fats in our diet, which we're not getting in the diet. And instead, we're flooding our bodies with foods or food-like substances that deplete these vitamins and minerals in our body. So it's kind of a double whammy. We're not eating them, and the foods that we are eating are depleting them. So eventually you get a disease. I mean, that's the rule of nature.
So what about supplements?
Well, we really talk about food. I mean, there is a place for supplements, but they should be just that. They should be supplemental to a good diet. And everyone will need different supplements. Someone with a lot of allergies may benefit from taking vitamin C. Someone who comes from a family where there's a lot of mental illness, they might benefit from taking B12. One thing we do recommend for everyone, which we really call a food, not a supplement, and that's cod liver oil, because cod liver oil provides the A and D that were so prevalent in the traditional diets. And, you know, cod liver oil was used throughout the world up until the Second World War.
Now let's speak, yeah, definitely. Let's speak a little bit more here about, you mentioned it already, of course, a little bit about some of the foods on the eat list and not to eat list. But, and we'll talk more about, you have a cookbook and things like that. We'll talk more about that a little bit later. But give us a little bit more about what you overall think is a good diet now. I mean, in some places too, it's difficult actually to get organ meats or even bone marrow in some stores these days, and people might not know where to turn even to get some of these, right?
Yes, well, this is one of the things our local chapters do, is keep a list of where to find these foods, and you can call them. And we have two chapters in Sweden, by the way.
Great.
You find their names on our website. You can call them, and they'll email you this list and where the farms are and so forth. So, yes, they've kind of disappeared from regular stores, but they're coming back in specialty stores. A lot of times in the States, you can go right to the farm and buy these foods. We also advocate raw milk, as you know, and that is an important nutrient-dense food that's hard to find. In some states in the U.S., you can get it in stores. In other states, you have to go to the farm.
Is that still illegal in some states, as it is in Europe? In some
well,
European
I like
countries?
To point out, it's illegal to sell, but it's not illegal to purchase, possess, or consume.
Right.
And, you know, actually, very few countries in Europe where you can't get raw milk. And Sweden, unfortunately, is one of them.
That's right, yeah.
Sweden, Scotland. But it pretty much throughout the rest of Europe, you can get raw milk. Certainly in the UK and in Ireland and Wales, you can get it.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I remember many years ago we had a raging debate. They actually sold it. It was sold in the stores, but it was sold under the label cat food.
Yes, right. Uh-huh.
So they kind of had a legal workaround on that. But I think they stopped that again, and there's been a tremendous demonization process of this. And I'm very curious as to why this is, you know, because the science doesn't support that their findings, right?
Right, right. They can't make this accusation anymore with a straight face because we have years of records on safety, and we also know a lot about the health benefits of raw milk. A lot of studies coming out of Europe showing that raw milk provides very important protection against asthma, allergies, and eczema in children, and even respiratory illness. So the real objection is from the dairy industry, and what they are concerned about is having to pay a higher price for their milk. Because, you see, the farmers in their system are locked into a price which tends to be very low. In the States, they get between $1 and $2 a gallon. And if they're selling raw milk, they can get anywhere from $8 to $15 a gallon. So it's considerably higher, and the dairy industry would just collapse if they had to pay these kind of prices to the farmers. But, you know, the dairy industry in America is collapsing anyway. Fewer and fewer people can drink pasteurized milk. It's the number one allergen.
Yeah.
Sales of fluid milk decline from 1% to 3% every year, and the biggest dairy manufacturer recently had to close 12 processing plants. And it really sent shockwaves in the industry.
Do you think that these things, why people develop allergies, is because it's not hardwired for the bodies, and now we're seeing more and more consequences? I mean, we have celiac disease with the gluten as well. You have the milk lactose issue, right?
Yeah, well, when they pasteurize, they warp and distort all the proteins in the milk, and the milk, it becomes highly allergenic and very difficult to digest. And it's a similar thing with grains. Grains contain proteins, and when the grains are extruded, as in making breakfast cereals, they're warped and distorted and become very hard to digest and allergenic. So we've done the same thing to our grains that we've done to our milk.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about the follies of political correctness on this program for many years now. But the cookbook you sell, of course, is called Nourishing Traditions, the cookbook that challenges politically correct nutrition and the diet dictators.
Dictocrats.
Yes, there we go. Exactly. So, is the nutritional issues is that connected to the politically correct agenda?
Yes, the agenda in the United States, and I think it's the same in Sweden, is to get everybody on low-fat foods, and it's basically starving people, starving our children, and then what happens, I say that people think they have to eat this puritanical diet, and when they develop tremendous cravings, and they end up eating what I call the pornographic foods. And there's got to be something in the middle. Why not just eat good, nourishing, satisfying foods? And that means including fat in your diet.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a little bit more about the cookbook and what people can find in there.
Oh, okay, so the cookbook's been out now almost 20 years. It's something of a classic. And in the book, it's a very comprehensive book that addresses organ meats, fats, raw milk, how to prepare your grains, lacto-fermented foods like sauerkraut, and really delicious lacto-fermented soft drinks like kombucha. I don't know if you have that.
Oh, definitely. It's great. I have it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a wonderful alternative to soft drinks and also to alcohol. We've had lots of alcoholics get off alcohol by just switching to kombucha. And also the making of broth, and this is something that traditional cultures always did. They used the whole animal and they cooked the bones and they made the gelatinous broth, which we now know is very important for our health, a very healing food.
Definitely. Now, so these are, just to reemphasize this point again, but they're traditional foods. I mean, we're in a time now of progressivism. People believe we're advancing, we're getting better things. But in my view, we're actually, I wouldn't say we're going backwards. That was the wrong thing. We're basically going over the cliff.
We're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, on so many fronts here. So basically, the appeal here is to try to go to back to traditional food. I would even suggest this on many other level as well, just to because I think it's intricately tied to the way people think, even, Sally, and the way that our brains work when we get high rich, you know, fats and things like this.
Oh, absolutely.
There's kind of a dumbing down going on right now.
Oh, that there is, and I believe it's deliberate. No, the brain needs cholesterol. The brain needs fats. And if you want a population of drones and zombies who can't think for themselves, there's no better way to do that than to bring them up on low-fat diets, junk food, and industrial seed oils. And we've seen this in the States. IQ is plummeting in our schools.
Absolutely. You're right. Exactly. Now, what about do you tackle the GMO issue at all? Is that a worrying element to you?
You know, when I wrote Nourishing Traditions, GMOs were a little speck on the horizon.
Yeah,
We're just starting to hear about them. And now, of course, they're everywhere, especially in animal feed, but also in certain foods that are on the marketplace, like canola oil and so forth. Fortunately, not in wheat yet, because that would be a disaster. But we certainly have at the Weston A. Price Foundation, we have addressed the dangers, the health dangers of GMOs, and not only GMOs, but the Roundup, the herbicide that's used with them. And now, for years we've been assured that Roundup is completely safe, and now it seems that it is not safe, and especially over the, long term, it can be very damaging.
Is there anything else you would want to mention about Weston Price or anything, what happened to him? Or maybe, I know that he wrote some books himself, of course. One of them was Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, right?
Well, and yes, and the good thing is that book is still in print and has influenced a lot of people. We have two organizations, our own and the one in California, that promote his work and his research. But he's never been accepted by the mainstream because what he found is completely at odds with kind of the scientific zeitgeist that we have today.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we'd like to hear that. Is there any other element here of what we haven't spoken about?
Well,
so far?
Yes, please go to our website. It's westonaprice.org, westonaprice.org. We'd love to have your listeners as members. The members get our journal and become a part of our community. So please have a visit to our website. And if you're new to the website, there's a tab that you can click on called Take a Tour.
Yeah, exactly. Very good. We're going to have the link up, of course, so people can click through easily
from
there.
Oh, that'd be great.
And it is a foundation. And is there anything else you want to mention about the foundation of what you guys do?
Well, we're entirely supported by memberships. We don't get any funding from the food industry or the government, and that's a good thing because it allows us to be completely independent.
Yeah, you bet. I want to mention the book again here as well, Nourishing Traditions, the cookbook that challenges politically correct nutrition and the diet dictocrats. That's how you pronounce it. Anyway, so where can people pick up a copy of the book?
Well, online booksellers, of course. I'm assuming you have Amazon there.
Sure.
Sweden. But also I have a website called New Trends Publishing, NEWTRENDS Publishing, which is my company that publishes the book. So all the titles I do publish are there.
All right, well, that's to the point, nice and concise. The time just flew by here, Sally, but thank you so much for coming on. It was great having you, and please keep up the good work, and maybe we can do it again in the future.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's great to reach a larger audience in just the United States. Thank you.
That's it for today, folks. But if you enjoy what we do, you'll love redicemembers.com, our members' website, where we have subscriptions for you for our full shows, both hours. And sometimes we only do 1 hour, since some of our guests do have time restraints. But almost all of our shows are 2 hours. And we also have Insight videos, TV episodes, the full Radio 314 archive with Lana Lochteff, and all the other material that we have been doing and working on since our start in 2006. And you also can comment on our shows as well, so you can join in on the discussion with our other members. Tell us what you think about the shows. We'll be back with John Friend here in just a couple of days from the Realist Report. Until then, we say thank you so much for listening, and do join us at redicemembers.com. Stay healthy, stay strong, and remember to get in touch with your primordial essence. Have a good day.